This morning, I want to talk to you about a scandal. In fact, I want to talk to you about a sexual scandal this morning. It involves a woman who some would say was coerced to make an appearance before a panel with very highly partisan and political motives, whose members intend to use the allegations regarding the woman to discredit the integrity of a controversial public figure. I'm talking, of course, about the story of the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8, which is our next passage in the Gospel of John. It is just sort of ironic that the recent events in the news have had so many similarities in one way or another with this account. It's interesting to me that sexual scandals and political manipulation are certainly not anything new. And whether in the current particular case in our country, the person who is making the accusations is telling the truth or not, it does certainly seem to me that the people who are advocating on her behalf don't really seem to be so much interested in her as much as they are interested in manipulating the story for very crass political reasons. Just like the scribes and the Pharisees here in this account in John chapter 8. But before I say much more about this text, there's actually an even more fundamental issue that we need to deal with. And that issue is whether this passage in John chapter 8 even belongs in the Bible. Whether the Apostle John actually even wrote this passage. Now, if you use the New American Standard Bible, or the English Standard Version, or the New International Version, you will see some kind of footnote, or some kind of bracket, or some other sort of symbol that is designed to alert you that there is a serious question about the authenticity of this passage. For example, if you use the English Standard Version, it has a note just above verse 53. The earliest manuscripts do not include 753 through 811. And then you can see that it's set off in brackets. All right, those of you who use the New American Standard, raise your hands again. Those of you still clinging to your New American Standard Bibles around here, okay. You should see something like that as well in your Bible, right? The New American Standard has a footnote on the passage that says, later manuscripts add the story of the adulterous woman. In other words, this was not actually a part of the original Gospel of John. It was added later. Those of you who use the New International Version, raise your hands, you NIV people. All right, there's a few scattered among you. You actually have the most detailed note of any of the translations that I consulted. The NIV gives this very thorough explanation. It says, the earliest manuscripts and many other ancient witnesses do not have John 7:53 through 8:11. A few manuscripts include these verses, wholly or in part, and then it points out that they're actually included at different places, like John 7:36, John 21:25, and even a couple of places in the Gospel of Luke. And then those of you who use the New King James Version, now raise your hands. Look, Wade is a proud New King James Version partisan, that's right, and a few others here among you. You have a note as well, and it says this, the NU. So if you've ever noticed in your New King James Version, it has this abbreviation a lot in the footnotes, the NU. What that refers to is the standard Greek texts that scholars of the New Testament use. It says that this brackets chapter 7, verse 53 through 8:11 as not in the original text. Although it does go on to say in this footnote in the New King James Version, it is found in 900 other manuscripts. All right, now, I'm actually 100%, what's the word that I want here? I'm just curious, I guess is the right way to put it. And don't be ashamed or embarrassed if you answer yes to this question, but I am, just to kind of gauge how much more detail to go into this morning, how many of you are, for the very first time right now, hearing that there is a serious question as to whether this story was actually a part of the story of the Gospel of John? Raise your hand if this is the first time you actually have heard it. Okay, that's just fine. Now, some of you have heard details about this before, some of you have not. That's okay. So I think it might be good for me to take just a little bit of time this morning to talk about the whole issue of how people come to conclude that something is actually a part of the Gospels or not. Now, the simplest way to solve this would be, somebody go find the actual handwritten Gospel of John that the Apostle John wrote, and let's just scroll through it and see if this text is in there or not. But, of course, we can't do that. We can't do that because we don't have the actual first edition handwritten copy of the Gospel of John or any of the other books of the Bible as far as that goes. What we do have are thousands and thousands of manuscript copies. And some of them date very close to the actual time of the Apostle John. What I'm showing you here is a fragment of the Gospel of John. If you could read it in Greek and you knew the Gospel of John really well, I can kind of read the letters, but that's about it. But you would know that it's from John chapter 18. And this fragment has been dated by some people to the year 125, which puts it within just a few decades of when John actually wrote his gospel. So we don't have the original actual Gospel of John that the apostle wrote. We can't go look it up, but what we do have are thousands upon thousands of copies of manuscripts and manuscript fragments of the New Testament. And so we can look at those copies and check them out. And when you look at those copies, you will find that there are some differences between those copies. The vast majority of differences are simple spelling variations. Like, for example, the name John the Baptist. In Greek, it could have one letter nu or n, or it could have two. And sometimes it's spelled one way and sometimes the other in the Gospel of John. You can understand how, if scribes are hearing someone read the manuscript and they're copying it by ear, and somebody thinks John should be spelled with one n and some two, you can understand how there could be a difference. Speaking of which, talk about coincidence. We had some new neighbors move in next door to us a couple of years ago, and the guy's name, my next door neighbor, Sean Scott. Now, what are the chances that side by side you would have Shane Scott and Sean Scott? And we get each other's mail all the time, and you can understand why, right? If you're the postal worker and you look at it, you see the name, you're kind of used to giving mail to this certain address. And then we had a very embarrassing thing happen this week. They got one of our packages, we got one of theirs, but we weren't paying attention and we opened it. And so then I had to sneak over, like put it in the front door, you know, so I let them know that we opened. All right? So you can understand if a scribe is hearing the word John, he might spell it with one N or two. Another common mistake that you'll see among these variations is sometimes a scribe may double a line, or he may omit a line as he's copying. And you can clearly see this when it happens. It's actually very rare that you would have a huge section of Scripture in which there is a variation, like is the case here at the opening of John chapter 8. So then, how would you decide, if you see a difference like this, what the best way to adjudicate the matter is? Well, here is the choice you have to make. The oldest manuscript copies we have of the Gospel of John do not contain this story. But because they are the oldest, and by virtue of the toll that time takes, there's very few of those manuscripts that have survived because they are very old. So the ones that do not have this story are the oldest, so therefore they are the closest in time to the Apostle John, but there's also only a handful of them. On the other hand, the vast majority of manuscripts of the New Testament do contain this story, but they are also the ones that date to much later, most of them to the medieval period. So when that footnote in the New King James says there are 900 manuscripts that have it, that's true, but there are many hundreds of years after the time John wrote the gospel. So here is the choice you have to make. We're going to vote on it this morning, all right? American democracy in action. You have to choose, do I go with the older but fewer manuscripts? They don't have the account in it. Or do I go with the majority, but they are much later from the original? So which is better? So, in principle, if you think it would be better in a situation like this to go with the older but fewer manuscripts, raise your hand. Okay? Now, you people take the same philosophy that the New American Standard, New King James, New International Version, English Standard Version, excuse me, not the New King James, but the NASB, the ESV, the NIV, etc. How many of you think it's better to go with the majority, even though they are much later than the original? Raise your hand. All right, you're King James only people, right? Or New King James people. How many of you didn't raise your hands at all? Wake up! What are you doing this morning? We're about on something important here. What are you doing? Somebody elbow them here. Get them to pay attention. All right. Well, so that's the choice you have to make. Now, what most people think is, who study this sort of thing, that all things considered, it is better to go with the older but fewer manuscripts because they would be closer to the original. And if that is the case, then most likely this story was not actually in the fourth gospel when the Apostle John wrote it. Now, you might be wondering, why are you spending so much time on this? This seems like such an arcane and trivial point. And I want you to know that there is someone that you can specifically blame for me going into so much detail, and it is John Haley, Jr., not senior, junior, over here, or the third, or whatever you are here. Yeah, the third, all right. So let me tell you why. Not long after I moved here, John told me that he had a parent who was raising trouble at his school because some of the after-school activities, I guess, are sort of like faith-based, or there's Bible studies or things like that. And I guess this guy was either an agnostic or an atheist, and he was really upset by it. And John said, he gave me a book, and I wanted to know if you kind of look at it, try to see where this guy's coming from. So what I assumed is that this guy had a book about things like, you know, the separation of church and state, or religious liberty, or all that kind of thing, and that it was going to be something, you know, like by the ACLU or whatever. And instead, it was this book that he had given John. This book is called Misquoting Jesus by Bart Ehrman. And the subtitle is The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. Very sensationalistic. Bart Ehrman grew up in a very conservative, fundamentalist religious environment, went to college and started studying some of these sort of things. And his faith, which I think he would admit was pretty fragile to begin with, began to be shaken as he started to study the fact that there are these differences in the manuscripts of the New Testament. And so he began this slow move away from belief in the perfection of the Bible. Then he stopped believing in the reliability of the Bible. Then he stopped believing in Christ. And now basically he doesn't believe in God. That's the trajectory. Well, he decided to write this book for what I think, quite honestly, is a very sinister reason. Bart Ehrman knows that anybody who studies the New Testament in detail knows that there are these manuscripts and there are these variations. But he knows that the average person in the pew doesn't know that. And so by writing a book like this, he can sensationalize something that's just a very nondescript fact about the Bible, but take advantage of the fact that most preachers never talk to their congregations about these sorts of things and begin to try to sow doubts in the minds of people about whether they can trust the Gospels or not. And quite frankly, based on the number of emails I get from young people on a regular basis who have followed the very same path of Bart Ehrman, he's been pretty, and people like him have been pretty successful. So 30 years ago, when I first started preaching, I would not have actually talked about this kind of thing in a Sunday morning sermon. But here's the deal. Times have changed. And now I know that when some of our kids go off to college and they go to a school that's, you know, sort of your typical secular university, where they're going to be people who are very hostile to the New Testament, they may decide because they're Christians, hey, look, my school offers an introduction to the New Testament. I think I'll sign up and take that class. And most likely, the textbook they will use is Bart Ehrman's Introduction to the New Testament. And then he will start to sow doubts in their minds that should never really bother them if somebody had just simply told them the facts of life when it comes to the New Testament. Or you get an email for it from one of your atheist friends who says, hey, you know that story of the womankind adultery? Isn't that a great story? Yeah. Did you know it wasn't really in the Bible? I wonder why it's there. Who made that change? And try to undermine your faith. So as far as I'm concerned, the best way to handle this is just simply to talk very straight in a very public forum about what the actual facts are. And here is what the fact is. It is nothing new at all that there are different manuscripts of the Greek New Testament and that there are variations among them. Anybody who owns a Greek New Testament knows this. Here's mine. It's not very well worn, as you can see, but here's my Greek New Testament. And at the top of the page is the actual text. Do you see this space here and then this huge section right here? That's page after page of variations that any standard Greek New Testament points out. Here are where the differences are, and here's this potential strength and weakness of these readings. Most of us, even if we've never opened a Greek New Testament, have Bibles that have footnotes that alert us to these things if we just actually bother to ever read the footnotes. So that's the first thing that you should know. There is nothing in this book that should be surprising or shocking to any Christian. As a matter of fact, there is an organization called the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts that you can actually go to their website, because what they are doing, they are actually collecting digital pictures of all of these thousands, 5,000 plus Greek manuscripts that have been discovered. You can go online and look at them to your heart's content. There are people who do this for a living. And the other thing that will be very clear when you start to look at all of these different manuscripts is that even where there are significant differences, like the case here of John chapter 8, there is nothing that is in any sense vital to Christianity. So let me just illustrate this. Let's read this account. And as we read it, I want you to ask yourself this question. Should it prove to be the case that this was added later and was not a part of the original gospel, do I lose anything crucial to my faith if this text should not be in the Gospel of John? All right? So we'll start in 7:53. They went each to his own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Early in the morning, he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and placing her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman has been caught in the act of adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. So what do you say?" This they said to test him, that they might have some charge to bring against him. But Jesus bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. And as they continued to ask him, he stood up and said to them, "Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her." And once more he bent down and wrote on the ground. But when they heard it, they went away one by one, and beginning with the older ones, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus stood up and said to her, "Woman," and remember in Greek it's basically the idea of madam or ma'am, "where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more." So let me ask you this. Is there anything about being a Christian that uniquely hinges on this text? In other words, if this text was not in the gospel, it would potentially bring down the entire structure of Christianity. Anything? Not at all. Is there anything in this passage that is the only place in the New Testament that says something about, like, for example, the deity of Jesus, or his atoning death and resurrection, or baptism, or heaven and hell? No, there is nothing in this text that is vital, that Christianity rests on. And that is the case with all of these variations in the New Testament manuscripts. Furthermore, the fact is that if you look at this story, although this account may not be authentic, there's certainly nothing in this account that is foreign to us. We can see examples of all the things found in this story in other places in the Gospels. For instance, is this the only place in the New Testament that talks about scribes and Pharisees trying to trip up Jesus? Of course not. You can see stories like that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Is this the only passage that shows that Jesus took a special interest in abused and mistreated and rejected women? Not at all. We've even seen some of those in the Gospel of John. Is this the only place in the New Testament that captures Jesus' compassion and also his challenging conviction? Not in the least. And the same can be said of all the other variants in the New Testament as well. And so I have to tell you, if anybody reads a book like this and finds their faith wobbling, the simple reason is we just have not done the job we should in teaching people the basic background of where the New Testament came from. So here's what I think. It seems very likely to me that the Apostle John did not write these words for several reasons. Number one, as I've already said, these verses are absent from the very earliest copies of the Gospel of John. Second, these few verses contain several words that are found nowhere else in the Gospel of John. This is the only place where John uses the word scribes, if he did. It's the only place where he talks about the Mount of Olives. Third, wherever this text does appear in the Greek manuscripts, it almost always is accompanied by a note or a symbol to indicate the scribe thought, nah, I'm not so sure about this. And then as that note from the NIV indicates, where it does appear in the New Testament manuscripts, it jumps around. Sometimes it's in John 7, sometimes it's here in John 8, sometimes it's at John 21. A couple of different manuscript families have it even in the Gospel of Luke itself. And then to me, here is the clinching and decisive factor. There were people in early church history who preached through the Gospels, like I'm preaching through John. And they wrote commentaries on the Gospel of John. In those earliest sermons and commentaries of early Christians, when they preach through the Gospel of John or write about it, they don't ever mention this passage. They go straight from what we call the end of chapter 7 right on to chapter 8 and verse 12. So my best judgment based on this evidence here is most likely this story was not a part of the original Gospel of John. But let me say one more thing about it. Just because this story may not have been a part of the actual gospel that John wrote, that doesn't mean this didn't happen. See, those are two different things. In fact, if I had to guess, this story or something like it did happen, and many of the earliest Christians knew about it and had circulated the story, but that's why you can see it pop up at different places in the Greek manuscripts. We know that Jesus said and did many things that are not actually recorded in the Gospels. You know how we know that? Look at the last verse of the Gospel of John. Look at John chapter 21. John says this in John 21 and verse 25. Now there are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. And in my judgment, this account falls into that category here. But what is so ironic is that even though this passage has such a shaky manuscript history, it's actually one of the few passages it seems like everybody knows. In fact, it seems like in the world, if there are two passages non-Christians know in all the Bible, it is, judge not lest you be judged, and he that is without sin cast the first stone. They don't really care about much else, but now those two, it seems like everybody knows. And in fact, usually when this passage is brought up, the reason that it is brought up is to basically say nobody ever has any right to criticize the actions of anyone else. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have heard someone use this passage to make that very point? More of you are awake right now. That's fantastic. All right, I thought you'd be gone, but good. Very good. But yeah, I've heard people do the same thing. As a matter of fact, all you got to do, if nothing else, you can just do a Google search. He that is without sin cast the first stone. You'll find all kinds of examples of this. I found this happens to be earlier this year, a letter to the editor of a newspaper Hayes, Kansas, and you can see the title, that he that is without sin cast the first stone. And this person is particularly upset at those who would oppose LGBTQ rights and so forth. And the letter writer brings up the story here in John 8 and then says, Jesus cleverly spoiled their attempt to trick him into condemning the woman by pointing out that everyone has committed sexual sin and invited any among them who was pure to cast the first stone. Just like Jesus' revelation shamed the adulterous woman's accusers into abandoning their persecution of her, these people, this organization, should be shamed into abandoning their persecution of LGBT folks and worry about their own sexual sins. Persecuting people for being how God made them is not only morally wrong, doing so constitutes pure hate. Well, let's think about this a little more carefully. First of all, when Jesus said, "He that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone," Jesus was not talking about criticizing other people. Do you know what he was talking about? Casting stones. That's what he was talking about, executing people. Jesus was not saying in this passage that it is always and forever wrong to criticize what somebody else says. And so to apply this to any sort of critical assessment is just simply absurd. Furthermore, when Jesus said to the scribes and Pharisees, "Let he that is without sin among you cast the first stone," he was actually criticizing them. You get that, right? They were misusing this woman, and Jesus was implicitly saying, "You're guilty of sin in what you're doing, because if you aren't, then feel free to go ahead and cast the first stone." Isn't it ironic that in making the statement, "He that's without sin cast the first stone," Jesus was not condemning criticism, he was making a criticism, criticizing the scribes and the Pharisees. Furthermore, in this passage, when Jesus says, "He that is without sin, cast the first stone," Jesus doesn't mean that the only way you could ever criticize what anybody else does is if you were sinlessly perfect. If that's what Jesus meant, then we couldn't do other things that Jesus told us to. You remember in Matthew 18, he says, "If your brother sins, go to him in private and talk to him about his fault. And if he repents, you've won your brother." Now, if you have to be completely and totally sinlessly perfect, who could ever carry out what Jesus says in that passage? No, what Jesus is talking about here is not the idea that in order to ever criticize someone else, you could have never, ever have made a mistake. What he's talking about is a situation in which the scribes and Pharisees were clearly at fault in the very thing they were doing. I mean, think about the scenario here. They bring a woman to Jesus who is caught in adultery. The very first suspicious thing about this story is, if they caught her in adultery, where is the other person? At a minimum, you would say that they are certainly practicing justice with inequity and unfairness by singling out the woman in the story. In the second place, John tells us here in this account, if in fact he wrote it, that Jesus understood they were doing this simply in order to test him. And maybe that explains why they weren't all that concerned about making sure they were doing this fairly, because fairness and justice have nothing to do with what's going on here. What's going on here is an effort to try to trip Jesus up somehow. And if that's the case, just think about the inhumanity and the cruelty of what they're doing. Because if in fact this woman is going to be put to death, these people are willing to play games with the life of this woman simply to try to score points against Jesus. And because Jesus knows that, that's why he says, if you're without sin, not absolutely and forever utterly sinless, but if you are without sin in this action, then you feel free to cast the first stone. Which is the reason that, of course, they knew not. They do not. And finally, it's very ironic that when people say, "Hey, you shouldn't criticize others, he that's without sin cast the first stone," when people say that, guess what they're doing? They're criticizing you. I mean, that's the irony here. When people tell you, "Oh, you're wrong to do this because he that's without sin cast the first stone," they're accusing you of sin and saying you shouldn't do this. Look again at the last couple of lines here of this letter to the editor. "If you stand for the biblical position on these particular issues, you are morally wrong." That sounds like a criticism to me. And it constitutes pure hate. That's a pretty big stone being heaved at my head just now here. And yet these people seem to have no problem believing they should do that when they think there's behavior that deserves it. And bingo. That's the whole point. When you think that there is a standard of right that is being violated, then what you should do is point it out. And you know, to use this passage as an excuse never to allow your behavior to be challenged by Jesus actually misses the whole point that we should take away from this exchange. What Jesus says to her is, neither do I condemn you. Go and from now on, what? Sin no more. Yes, Jesus showed her grace and forgiveness, but it was also supposed to transform her, just like we saw in the story of the lame man in John 5 when Jesus confronts him in the temple. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen. This is always the way grace works in the Bible. Yes, grace gives us mercy, it gives us forgiveness as a gift, but it also challenges us, it confronts us, it criticizes us so that we can be changed and be what God wants us to be. And if, in fact, this story was authentic, then what is taking place here is that Jesus is with one hand showing great mercy to this woman, but on the other hand, transforming her by his power so that she can truly be the kind of person that she should be. It doesn't say here, hey, look, you just go keep on doing whatever you think you should, whatever you feel like you were born to do, whatever you want to do. Forgiveness always leads to renewal, to rebirth, to resurrection, to a transformation, which is what Jesus calls this woman to do in the text. Now, if it is the case that the textual evidence for the inclusion of this story is so weak, why is it that all of our Bibles still have them in there? Even when they like have brackets. Hey, this really isn't in there. Or a footnote. Hey, this hasn't been in any of the early. Why do our Bibles still include it? Here's what I think. I think the Bible editors know that people love this story because we all can resonate with it. Because we all know what it's like to be guilty of sin. And we all love the blessing of Jesus to forgive us. But here's what I would say to you. If you are a Christian, you don't need this story to identify with the gracious forgiveness of Jesus. You're already living that story. You already have sinned and been condemned. You've already been charged with your sins by the accuser. You've already been given the sentence of death, only for Jesus to pardon you and lift it. If you've become a Christian, if you have come to Jesus trusting in his death and being baptized into him, he's raised you to new life. And you know what? Jesus, he's already said to you, this is your story. Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. That's all of our stories, if we're Christians. And if you're not a child of God, it can be your story. It can be your story this morning. And if we can help you, let us know how while we stand and sing.